I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There are moments of utter delight in the story of the Russian man trying to make his way as a professor in America. That moment when he finally gets used to his new false teeth. The time when he learns to drive a car. Now, much of the rest of Panin's story details the frustration and the confusion of life in an unfamiliar land. Panin is written by Vladimir Nabokov, the highly regarded Russian author who did much of his writing in English and all of it away from the land of his birth. Panin and Nabokov lead off our look this week at exile and literature, an exploration of the perspective of authors who toil in that place between the land of their birth and the place they happen to be calling home. Helping us with this two-part series is the writer and professor Azar Nafisi. Connection listeners, what is it that defines exile literature? And when a foreign-born writer calls America home, can that writer teach Americans something new? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And as I said a couple of moments ago, our guide over the next 2 days is Azar Nafisi. You may remember her from a program earlier this spring when we talked about her new book, Reading Lolita in Tehran. Azar is joining us from the NPR studios in Washington. Welcome back, Azar.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
Now, before we go to the Russian-born writer writing in America, I have to ask you, as my Iranian-born writer writing in America, what you're making of what's in the papers these days. Because every time I read stories of the students, the university students in Tehran, confronting the authorities there, I think of you, because you described here on the program, you know, seeing exactly that. Now, as we watch it today, is it different or is it just more of the same?
Well, you know, life, every moment of life being different, nothing is more of the same. But in a sense, there is a continuity to it. And I think that it is so relevant today that we're talking about Panin and about Nabokov, a writer who never put his trust in politics, but who became most subversive of all politics. And I think that the students in Iran today are fighting for what we would like to call the urge for freedom. And that is what Panin wanted to do as well. And so maybe we should dedicate this program to the students in Iran today. You know, Nabokov was very popular among the students. And I've had many letters and emails when I published my book on Nabokov. And Panin was the most popular among my students in Iran.
What was it that the students in Iran saw in the character Panin? We should perhaps just do a quick overview here. Panin, for those who haven't read the story, is a rather classically absent-minded professor, Russian professor, working at a small New England college and fumbling his way through life in a sort of likable way. Where was the link between that character, Azar, and what the students in Iran were reading when they were studying Nabokov?
Well, you know, all great works of art, you know, focus on one specific topic or theme, but their theme resonates on many levels. And on one level, Panin is about loss. I mean, it's about loss of his childhood, loss of his homeland, something that Nabokov himself experienced. And it's also about loss of culture, loss of language. And we living in Iran and my students living in Iran, we felt that although we were in the country of our birth, we had lost everything that we identified with the best of that country, which was its culture, its language. You talked about remembrance and memory. Mm. Our memory was being redefined by this new regime who was telling us that we were not what we thought we were, but what they now were claiming we are. Empathized with Panin's loss and Panin's heroic attempt to remain Paninian, as Nabokov would call, all through his life in exile.
Now, one of the parallels here, you can correct me if I get this wrong, is that the character Panin, in fact, leaves Russia at about the same time when the writer himself, Vladimir Nabokov, had to leave Russia.
He
fled the Soviet Revolution in the 1917. Is that right?
Yes.
And so what do we make of the connection between the writer himself, Nabokov, and the character Panin? Is it autobiographical?
You know, I think in another of his novels, The Gift, which was the last novel he wrote in Russian, the hero of that novel, Fyodor, who's also a writer, a young writer, tells his love that his novel is going to be autobiographical in the sense that it would carry the orange dust of his reality. It is autobiographical in that sense, in the sense that Nabokov had also felt the pain of exile and the pain of loss, and he tried to retrieve it through remaining true to himself and to the kingdom of imagination. But it is not autobiographical in the sense that Nabokov was Panin. I think that is just bad writing when we completely identify with our character in a very one-to-one and literal basis.
Now, all your students should note that down for the exam if they do.
Yes, I had to remind myself and them that we don't read works of fiction in order to sort of, I'm sorry to use this word, masturbate, and come back constantly to our own reality. We read works of fiction to discover the unknown, both in ourselves and in the world. And what Nabokov did, he made us realize those aspects of ourselves that we didn't know existed. And I think that is the power of his fiction.
You said a couple of moments ago, being true to the kingdom of imagination. If I remember something I read about Nabokov, he said imagination is the muscle of the soul. And how does it affect someone who is an exile writer? Because imagination should free you or me or Nabokov from any of those sorts
right.
of, borders or frontiers.
And it does. And it does because you're constantly, exile, and I think life is pain. And once Nabokov talks about how all beauty is anguish because all beauty must die. So we're constantly every moment dying anyway. And the only way that we can retrieve the lost moments is through our works of imagination, through a great painting, through a great work of art. And an exile writer, despite his or her loss, also has the power to see the world differently, because when you come into another country, and in this case it was US, you look at every object in this country through a different eyes and you redefine it. You remember Panin making love to the washing machine and getting excited? You mentioned about his teeth.
Yes.
So he makes Americans look at everything that is very mundane in their lives through different eyes. It is wonderful.
Do you have a copy of Panin there with you?
Yeah, yes, I do, actually. Yes.
I'm wondering if we can go to that little place where he describes the peculiarly American pleasure of getting a set of false teeth.
Yeah, it is so wonderful. Is that on page...
I have it on page 38 in my
38,
book.
38, yes.
Just the beginning of chapter 4.
That is... it is about his false teeth, and he says that it surprised him to realize how fond he had been of his teeth. His tongue, a fat, slick seal, used to flop and slide so happily among the familiar rocks, checking the contours of a battered but secure kingdom, plunging from cave to cove, climbing this jag, nuzzling that notch, finding a shred of sweet seaweed in the same old cleft. But now, not a landmark remained, and all there existed was a great dark wound, a terra incognita of gums, which dread and disgust forbade one to investigate. And when the plates were thrust in, it was like a poor fossil skull being fitted with the grinning jaws of a perfect stranger. I think here it is like the pain of exile. You are leaving the familiar kingdom, and you're replacing it with a new set of teeth, actually, which is very painful. And then he says that when 10 days had passed and suddenly he began to enjoy the new gadget, it was a revelation. It was a sunrise. It was a firm mouthful of efficient, alabastrine, humane America. At night, he kept his treasure in a special glass of special fluid where it smiled to itself, pink and pearly, as perfect as some lovely representative of deep sea flora. May I go on, or would this is this?
Let me just stop you there, if I can, because it's not the only place in the book where the character Panin defines whatever America is by something that the land produces, by something that's either available in America that may not be available in Russia. You know, almost like the soccer ball or anything that that becomes an image that he holds and touches in the novel.
That is exactly it. And he does the same thing with the English language. You know, he talks about like gazing. He calls it grazing, I think. And then he becomes so fascinated by the washing machine that he throws in his shoes in order to watch it, you know. And also, of course, the Americans are constantly misspelling him and misrepresenting him and also giving him new definitions. And I think that this is the gift he brings to this country, that everything that is deeply American, not just in terms of literature or culture or politics, but in terms of their everyday life, Tenin looks at with joy and wonder.
He takes, I think, more comfort in his imagination than Nabokov hints that Americans might do, that he lives in that place as if he goes there for some sort of comfort or solace. Do you think that?
Yes, and of course, you mentioned the theme of exile, and I think that does relate to exile. When your reality becomes very fragile, and when you cannot trust it anymore. I mean, you know, when I lived in Iran, I felt that even the little things that I had at night, I might not have in the morning. This bed I was sleeping in, these four walls that were protecting me. So as an exile, you learn to move inwards into a world that the cruel world outside cannot take away from you. And Panin is very Paninian. Nabokov keeps mentioning and reminding us that everything he did was uniquely Panin and nobody else would be doing it. And those people who appreciated this were the people who were allowed to enter into his world, whether they were Americans or not.
When he Paninizes the office that he's given at the university, though you hear this fabulous bit of writing of Nabokov when he talks about the new pencil sharpener being installed and the Ticonderoga sound that it makes when it grinds away the yellow paint. I mean, I read that and I thought to myself, I don't think that observation would have been made by someone who'd have grown up with that pencil sharpener in every classroom.
I'm so glad you're mentioning this because this is what great fiction is all about, to give us a new way of looking at the most mundane and to remind us that nothing is mundane. Just imagine how much thought and imagination has gone into the creation of a pencil sharpener. And it would take someone with Nabokov's imagination to remind us that nothing in this life is ordinary. We are all extraordinary. And this clock right in front of me right now that I'm looking at,
which is telling you that we're just about going to a break. So let me stop you there. And Connection listeners, let you know that our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about exile and literature this hour with the Iranian writer Azar Nafisi, and interested in hearing from you how we define exile literature and what it is that the observations of people who may not have been born in this country have to teach people here. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is W.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. We're in the first of our two-part series on exile and literature this hour with the Iranian writer Azar Nafisi. And today we're discussing Vladimir Nabokov and his novel Panin. Connection listeners, from you, what do you think defines exile literature? And when a foreign-born writer calls America home, what can that writer teach Americans about this place? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And we've been talking about the Russian-born Vladimir Nabokov. He died back in 1977, nearly 26 years ago, but we were able to find a recording of him, his voice, reading in 1952 a part of his poem, Exile.
This ivy resembles the eyes of the deaf. Come, leaf, name a country beginning with F. For instance, forget or farewell. Thus dimly he muses, and dreamily heeds his eavesdropping self as his body recedes, dissolving in sun-shattered shade. L'envoi, those poor chairs in the bois, one of which, legs up, stuck half-drowned in the slime of a ditch, while others were grouped in a glade.
That is the voice of Vladimir Nabokov reading from his poem, Exile. And Connection listeners, we're pleased to have with us now on the line from Montreux, Switzerland, Dmitri Nabokov, Vladimir Nabokov's son. He has translated numerous works by his father from Russian into English, and he's currently preparing a volume of his father's poetry, as well as writing his own autobiography. Dmitri, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm interested to know from your perspective whether or not you thought your father considered himself an exile writer. Would that have been a word he would use?
As the great Russian writer still in Russia, Bitov, said in response to all those who were claiming Nabokov for the Russians or for the Americans, the Americans have been a bit more generous. He said, Nabokov is a Russian writer who went out and conquered the cosmos. As for my father's own feelings, he suffered three great losses. The loss of his Russia, not the icons, samovars and balalaikas, but the tender scenery of his idyllic youth. Then the loss of his father, shot by political thugs. And finally, the loss of his language, his splendidly rich Russian, for which he had to substitute what he called a second-rate brand of English, which turned out to be a somewhat modest assessment.
I was going to say, this man's management of the English language ranks him up among the very best writers of the past century. He never felt constrained, did he, by having to write in English?
Oh, yes. His first English language novel, The Real Life of Sebastian Knight, was the object of much self-questioning, much self-doubt. He showed it to friends so that they could tell him if it sounded sufficiently English, sufficiently idiomatic. He had known Russian from a very early age. His father was an ardent Anglophile. My father read all the classics in his father's library, but reading is one thing. Conversing even in everyday English is one thing. But honing a language to the refinement with which he wrote Russian was quite another one. He wrote actually a poem on this subject, which I recorded it for an anniversary of The Atlantic some time ago. It was never collected. It was very seldom printed. It was written in 1941. It's a short poem called The Softest of Tongues, and it addresses that very issue that Azar mentioned before, the tragedy of losing one's language. To many things I've said the word that cheats the lips and leaves them parted, thus Prashchai, which means goodbye, to furnished flats, to streets, to milk-white letters melting in the sky, to drab designs that habit seldom sees, to novels interrupted by the din of tunnels, annotated by quick trees, abandoned with a squashed banana skin, to a dim waiter in a dimmer town, to cuts that healed, and to a thumbless glove. Also to things of lyrical renown, perhaps more universal, such as love. Thus life has been an endless line of land receding endlessly. And so that's that, you say under your breath, and wave your hand, and then your handkerchief, and then your hat. To all these things I've said the fatal word, using a tongue I had so tuned and tamed that, like some ancient sonneteer, I heard the echoes by posterity acclaimed. But now thou too must go, just here we part. Softest of tongues, my true one, all my own, and I am left to grope for heart and art and start anew with clumsy tools of stone.
Quite a treat, Connection listeners. That's Dmitri Nabokov reading a little-known poem of his father's, Vladimir Nabokov, and Azar Nafisi in Washington. I bet you had your eyes closed listening to that one.
Well, this is not done. I know how... I don't like to emote.
Go ahead, it's America. You can get away with
no,
it.
No, I hate it. I won't do that. But, you know, while Dmitri was reading Nabokov's poems, I was thinking over and over again, you have it in Penin and you have it in all his other works, that he might have been an exile and he had a portable world that, you know... was his home, but the real aliens were the ones who occupied Russia and who in my land are occupying ours. I mean, they were the ones who do not have possession of the language, who are the real aliens, you know, and the only guardians of the culture remain to be those who revive and resurrect the language the way Nabokov did. And I'm sorry I did this, because I was remembering how I lived in Iran and I felt not just like an exile, but like an alien because of what they were doing to my language, because of all the gardens of my childhood that they were being demolished in front of my eyes to create these monstrous high rises. And because of the mutilation of all the greatest classics of Persian literature. So my people have experienced the same feelings while living there. I'm sorry, I got a little emotional. Unfortunately, this one writer does this to me.
Dmitri, I want to come back to you, because your father described Russia as that ancestral estate in the latitude of Yukon, and in a kind of not a distant way, but a clever and thoughtful way. And I'm left wondering, I mean, he lived in the United States from the time he was about 40 to the time he was about 60, then moved to Montreux, Switzerland, and lived the balance of his life there near you, where your opera career was in full swing at that time. And did you see him as a melancholy man, a man who missed his homeland all of his life?
In spite of the melancholy mood that one might gather from some of the photographs that have circulated of my father, no, he was a very merry man, full of jokes, full of puns, with a fresh story to tell me every day at the age of 50, as he had when I was 5 or 6. He had composed little jingles and songs and verses for me when I was a little boy. And that same joie de vivre and that same... that same attitude toward me, engulfing me in a cocoon of love, persisted throughout his life. And he remained a very happy man, basically, because he was able to chase his butterflies in beautiful Switzerland. He was able to live in what, by some kind of strange spiral, was in a sense a reproduction of the childhood houses and hotels, the Montreux Palace in right down the hill where I'm speaking to you now. He found his little place. Actually, the room wasn't very big. It was a little nest where he ate and slept and wrote, starting upright in the morning at a kind of stand, and then gradually lowering himself to the seated position with the board across his knees, and finally continuing in bed at night. And as he said, sometimes the energy would return, and I would return to my standing position with a fresh burst of inspiration. He was never one to grieve actively for the, he reflected this in his poetry and in his writing, a certain nostalgia, not for the for the for the trappings, as I said, of some of ours, etc., of his youth, but for the air, for the smell of the woods, for the whole wonderful atmosphere that existed in the country houses and in the city house, which fortunately is now in the Bokhov Museum, run fairly well, and I hope destined for greater things, especially if it gets a bit of support. And he never seemed sad, except maybe for a moment just before his death in a Lausanne hospital, when his eyes filled with tears, and he said, Kali litait, it's a breed of butterfly. That means the Kalias are flying, and he knew he'd never see them again.
And throughout his writing, Azar, you and I take this tremendous pleasure in a brilliant sense of humor. That's you know, whether or not it's writing about something that is sad or melancholy, he always seems to bring that into his writing as well. I don't know whether or not that fits what we're talking about.
It was present in his everyday talk as well, even in such things as composing a laundry list or making some household remark. Everything would be laced with a Nabokovism, with an unusual little turn of phrase that somehow one had never thought of before.
I think that is the sign of great fiction. I mean, without that sense of irreverence, not just towards others, but just but towards yourself, and that sense of the absurdity that we all share. And you see it so much in Penin. Of course, Penin, along with his friend Clemens, belonged to the Serds. That is how the narrator describes them in the book. And I think that that is an integral part of his writing.
Later on, suggested that Penin might be, actually it was not Father, it was Brian Boyd who suggested that Penin might be a vindication of Don Quixote.
I mentioned it in my book.
You do?
Yes, my chapter on Penin is based on the fact that Penin is a Don Quixotean character and all that sense
of course, cruelty as well. Yes. That was an idea that Brian Boyd first expressed. And I don't know if Father actively and consciously did it, but he didn't like Cervantes' cruelty toward his character. And perhaps he did create an anti-Quixote. Your view that Lolita, for example, is in a sense can be analogously compared to the usurpation of a mind and a body by a despot, as happened in your country, can just as well be applied to Russia. Although I don't know if Father, who didn't really believe much in symbols, but he might have accepted that.
You know, he predicted this. I did not take it as a symbol, but I mean, what you mentioned about Don Quixote, I think that he resonates on the themes of pain and cruelty and love and imagination so deeply that, you know, it can be applied. I mean, in Penin, you have political cruelty of Stalin and the pain of exile. But then there is cruelty on very, very specific levels. And in his lectures on Don Quixote, he talks about the fact that the symphony of pain, I think he calls it, is not limited to the past. It is not a melody played by past. It exists in our everyday behavior, the way children might hurt one another, the police might confront the tramps. And he deals with cruelty not just in terms of the outside world, but within each and every one of us, you know. And that is why his themes are so resonant and they are so relevant to the world as it goes on and the world as it had gone on before.
Cruelty was what he hated most, if you can say he hated anything. If you read, of course, and you know Ben Sinister well, and I'm sure you know Invitation to a Beheading well, as you have said in your interviews and in your book, those are his ways of doing politics. He was not a journalist or an orator. He expressed it through his art. And one can see in those books, in particular, focus how he hated cruelty to children, to the weak, to the unusual, to the original, to those who were transparent, like Cincinnatus.
Dimitri, let me ask you, when you are the son of a writer who has all these magical ways of looking at the world from different perspectives, is he able to pass that along to you, or are those the sorts of perspectives that almost have to be lived in the way that he did? I mean, I know you've moved around a lot and done many things in your own career in life, but compare that to the exile perspective of your father.
Well, it is hard to say. He, in a sense, enjoyed the slight distance from his immediate world and the perspective it gave him, which abetted his art. I feel that way when I write, for example, or when I think. I'm happy to be slightly removed from what's around me, rather than being part of any one country, of any one world. I have my little microcosm, and otherwise I feel slightly foreign. It's a good, sweet feeling.
I was going to say, that's an enviable perspective to have. Mr. Nabokov, it's been great having you on the program. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Dmitry Nabokov, the son of Vladimir Nabokov, who is himself translator of many of his father's works from Russian into English, and has written numerous essays, lectures, and is in the process of writing his autobiography and pulling together a volume of his father's poems. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, the first in a two-part series, a conversation about exiles in literature. You heard Dmitry talking about that slight distance from his immediate world, a slightly different perspective. And we're interested in hearing from you about whether or not you see that, you read that, or you appreciate that in the eye of the person who may be writing in this country or writing about this country, but not be from here. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh, presenting a mindfulness retreat, The Heart of Happiness.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, the first in a two-part series about exile and literature. Our guest is the writer and professor Azar Nafisi. Her latest book is called Reading Lolita in Tehran, a memoir in books. She did a full long piece on Nabokov herself, but it has yet to be translated into English. Azar is also director of the Dialogue Project and a visiting professor of culture and politics at Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies. 1-800-423-8255 for you to join us, and we'll go to St. Gabriel, Louisiana, where Catherine has been waiting patiently on the line. Catherine, thanks for waiting.
Well, it was easy to wait. I was loving the poetry. I feel like I'm interrupted right now.
No, I'm glad you called. Tell me what you hear or see or read in exile literature, if we can use that term.
Sure. I actually was listening to a NPR program, Fresh Air, with Terry Gross a few years ago when she was interviewing Abraham Verghese, and I hope I'm not massacring his name. I don't have the book in front of me. But anyway, he was an Asian Indian who had migrated to the United States and had practiced as an MD and as a professor in my hometown in East Tennessee. And at the time I heard the interview with him with Terry Gross, I was living in Louisiana, so I felt like an exile in a reduced scale sense, that I was living in the flatlands and missing my mountains. So I went out and bought this book and just found his descriptions of, you know, where I grew up, just, you know, fascinating, hilarious, because they were so true.
And what did he see that you didn't see, or what did he describe that you wouldn't have described?
Well, a lot of the funniest things to me and the things that rang so true, especially now that I've lived in southern Louisiana, is that I grew up in the Bible Belt. And not being a Christian, he was fascinated by the rituals that go along with being in the Bible Belt and the fact that there was such a big deal made you know, between the very, you know, what even I now see as subtle distinctions in Protestantism.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about the rituals of, you know, everybody went to church on Sunday morning, went out to eat lunch on after church on Sunday afternoon, went to church on Wednesday night, watched the NFL games on Sunday afternoon and Monday night. And he was very aware of the very ritualistic patterns that we had there, and he compared them to rituals in India.
Rituals that you would not necessarily have even recognized as rituals,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Never would have even characterized that way, but he's right. I mean, they are very ritualistic behaviors and definitely something that I can see that someone not being from the country would find fascinating.
Catherine, that's a great observation. I'd love to hear Azar comment on this.
Well, yes, it is a great observation, and I just wanted to refer you to Penin, that in Penin, the idea that the Americans, some like this lady who just talked, appreciate all the vagrancies and diversions and new things that people from other countries can bring with them and can also see through those lenses their own country. But then there are also those in Penin's book, and I have experienced them here, where they try to categorize you and to constantly tell you what you as a foreigner should think, probably because they don't want to see anything different in their own lives. They want to view their own lives as something stable and stale and ongoing. So I think that's a very, very important point.
All right,
of how we can enrich one another.
Catherine, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Boston. Neil's on the line. Hi, Neil.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Sure. When I first heard the theme of this morning's program, I was reminded of an image from a Tarkovsky film. A director, as you know, was a Russian exile and created the work Nostalgia in Italy. And there's a scene in which a woman releases birds from within a statue inside of a church. And I think that for me, is what the exiled vision brings to the commonplace object. It releases the birds that, by looking through a veil of tears, it's as if the melancholy acts like the water on a stone at the beach. When you bring a stone home from the beach, it dries and it loses its luster. But keeping the veil of tears around the object keeps it alive. And I think that's what Tarkovsky was doing, or what Nabokov was doing as he was writing.
And what's the skill or the perspective of the exile that gives them that ability to describe or to take an event or circumstances and give it that kind of that image, Neil? What's your—
Well, it comes through the forced leaving of the home.
Right.
It comes back to that mythical theme of having to leave the house that the hero always does. And in this case, it's forced on the person, and they have to deal with that. And it brings that quality, that very resonant quality of melancholy into the voice, into the experience, into the perspective. And it deepens. It automatically deepens. It's as if you set a sounding board beneath each word that is written in pain. You know, I'm reminded of John of Gaunt's words from Shakespeare. They breathe truth that breathe their words in pain. And that there's that resonant quality that comes through and surrounds each word, each work, as it did for me when I saw that image by Tarkovsky, which I always— he's one of my heroes. And it's because of the exiled quality of vision that he brings to his work that transforms my own vision and the way I look at the world. That's why I keep a picture of him here above my desk.
Azar, go ahead.
Well, I'm just thinking that I mentioned Tarkovsky in my own book and his film Sacrifice, and how popular he was in Iran. We also empathized with him and discovered things in ourselves that we had never thought about. But, you know, as an exile, of course, we have different exiles. I mean, we have Penin, who looks at the world through fresh eyes the innocent eyes of a child. I mean, a child finds everything, the pots and pans in the kitchen, a fork, a knife, everything for a child is something new that he has to redefine and reacquaint himself with. But then we have also the other kinds of exiles in this book, Komarovs, who are supposed to be art teachers, but who try to create an image of themselves the way they think Americans should like Russians to be. And I have experienced it in here, where people expect me, because I come from a Muslim country and a woman, to carry an image and to come and become like the way these people think I am. Penin, you know, his friend Clemens says that our friend here, his verbal vagaries add a new thrill to life. His mispronunciations are mythopoeic. His slips of tongue are oracular. He calls my wife John. You know, I mean, this is the kind of joy that that curious kind of exile view brings to the life of his or her adopted country.
All right, Neil, thanks for that call. To Newton, Massachusetts now. Jean's on the line. Hi, Jean.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. I just want to say thank you to Dimitri for his continuing his father's work, because for us, I came from Russia in 78 after a long struggle, and we discovered Nabokov here. Nabokov was forbidden in Russia. You know, we could get a little bit, we could hear, but very little, you know, and I got all his work through the artist's publishing house, which does not exist anymore, and we just devoured it day and night, and it was a savior. We survived because of Nabokov outlook, because of his optimism, because the man who was a millionaire at the age of 18, lost everything, and started his life and discovered the beauty and wonder of life in everything he did.
So, Jean, tell me, you started reading his work 25 years ago. Was it in any way useful or instructive in giving you a pair of eyes through which to look at America?
Absolutely. Well, America, life. You know, America is part of life. Nabokov lived 20 years in Russia, 20 in America, 20 in Europe, and he really broke this life into these pieces, you know, where he, you know, every life consists of circles. And yes, absolutely. I think anybody who can, you know, make through some difficult pages of Nabokov, some people find him difficult, will see the way to live and the way to enjoy life and the way to make meaning of everything that you do every day. And that's, he still does. I don't think there is many writers, whether in English or in Russian. He did it in both languages, and Dimitri translated a lot of his work, and thank you for that. And there hasn't been much coming up written about Nabokov. I thought maybe...
We thought it was time to bring him back.
Yes, so absolutely. I really think it should be, because he did wonders for all of us.
Thanks so much for your call,
Jean. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Azar, I'm interested in your perspective on the exile perspective here, because it seems to me that the exile writer has a choice. One is to stay in that slightly altered state, to maintain that slight distance that Dimitri spoke of, mm-hmm. and the other is to work very hard at getting past that, to, you know, once you say someone's made a choice to live in America, to get past being an exile, to make America mm-hmm. home. Is that a conscious choice that the writer would have, or no?
No, you know, I think that all writers or all people who work through their imagination do need to keep that distance with their reality. I mean, say if a Saul Bellow or a Philip Roth or whoever, an American writer, Fitzgerald, they might live in U.S. for all their lives, but in order to describe the reality around them, they need to keep that distance. I think that in order to be a good writer, you need to do two things. One, dive deep into the experience that you want to express, and then keep your distance in order to be able to shape that experience. It is very much like the act of creation. You're both so much part of that experience, and yet you have to keep your distance in order not to molest it or not to, overwhelm it with your own desires and demands.
And is this a country where that type of exploration is welcome. And I mean, it is in so yes. many ways a nation of and for exiles, no?
You know, that is, I think that this is one reason that America still, not only when Nabokov was living here, but in my time as well, becomes still a land where you can realize your strangest dreams. It because it is based on accepting strangers. Who, I mean, this is a land where all these different groups of strangers are, you know, making it their home. So it is constantly redefining the concept of home. And if America loses that unique quality of celebrating, constant exiles, I think it will lose a lot of its present dynamism and vibrancy.
Now, when you come back this time tomorrow, we're going to be talking about Zora Neale Hurston, who
yes.
Americans claim is an American writer, but we've put her in the category of exile writer. Why are we doing that, Professor?
Well, I'm very happy that we're doing that because we want. I thought that part of our argument, at least, was that exile becomes a state of mind. It becomes a quality of life. And you do not necessarily have to leave the land that you're born in order to feel like an exile. And Zora Neale Hurston, not merely as an, not just as an African-American woman, which makes her experience unique at any point, but because of the kind of a person she was, because of that quality of imagination that she had, she speaks to us through how you can live in a land and still be an exile in it, and how you can rewrite that experience in a way that you can make that land your own. I think she's unique among the writers of her kind.
All right, Connection listeners. All right, class, your assignment for tomorrow.
No, it's not.
Their eyes were watching God. No, I just want the book club to have their copies handy. I'm sure it's the one of Hurston's that most of our listeners have read. It's certainly her most highly regarded. And Azar, thank you for your help today. I look forward to having you back again tomorrow.
This was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Azar Nafisi is our guest in our series on exile and literature. She'll be back with us tomorrow. We're talking about Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. We were also joined by Dmitry Nabokov on the program today from Montreux, Switzerland. A special thanks to those at the Woodbury Poetry Room at Harvard College Library for access to that archival recording of Mr. Nabokov reading his poem, Exile. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Gail Harris, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Lindsay Miller, Christina Rousseau, and Doug Sugertz. Our interns are Andrea Liebman, Lisa Rufino, and Kate Sarnowski. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR. Coming up next, Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Goldsmiths 3 for 20 years, offering a complete array of original, handcrafted fine jewelry and precious metals and rare gems, ready to wear or made to order, in Concord and at goldsmiths3.com.